This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Miguel Street by V.S. Naipaul. This book is read by Ron Butler. For My Mother and Kamla. 1. Bogart. Every morning when he got up, Hat would sit on the banister of his back veranda and shout across, "What happening there, Bogart?" Bogart would turn in his bed and mumble softly so that no one heard, "What happening there, Hat?" It was something of a mystery why he was called Bogart, but I suspect that it was Hat who gave him the name. I don't know if you remember the year the film Casablanca was made. That was the year when Bogart's fame spread like fire through Port of Spain, and hundreds of young men began adopting the hard-boiled Bogartian attitude. Before they called him Bogart, they called him Patience, because he played that game from morn till night. Yet he never liked cards. Whenever you went over to Bogart's little room, you found him sitting on his bed with the cards in seven lines on a small table in front of him. "What happening there, man?" he would ask quietly. And then he would say nothing for 10 or 15 minutes. And somehow you felt you couldn't really talk to Bogart. He looked so bored and superior. His eyes were small and sleepy. His face was fat, and his hair was gleaming black. His arms were plump. Yet he was not a funny man. He did everything with a captivating languor. Even when he licked his thumb to deal out the cards, there was grace in it. He was the most bored man I ever knew. He made a pretense of making a living by tailoring, and he had even paid me some money to write a sign for him. Tailor and Cutter. Suits made to order. Popular and competitive prices. He bought a sewing machine and some blue and white and brown chalks, but I never could imagine him competing with anyone, and I cannot remember him making a suit. He was a little bit like Popo, the carpenter next door, who never made a stick of furniture and was always planing and chiseling and making what I think he called mortises. Whenever I asked him, "Mr. Popo, what you making?" he would reply, "Ha, boy, that's the question. I'm making the thing without a name." Bogart was never even making anything like this. Being a child, I never wondered how Bogart came by any money. I assumed that grown-ups had money as a matter of course. Popo had a wife who worked at a variety of jobs and ended up by becoming the friend of many men. I could never think of Bogart as having mother or father, and he never brought a woman to his little room. This little room of his was called the servant room, but no servant to the people in the main house ever lived there. It was just an architectural convention. It is still something of a miracle to me that Bogart managed to make friends. Yet he did make many friends. He was at one time quite the most popular man in the street. I used to see him squatting on the pavement with all the big men of the street. And while Hat or Edward or Eddowes was talking, Bogart would just look down and draw rings with his fingers on the pavement. He never laughed audibly. He never told a story. Yet whenever there was a fete or something like that, everybody would say, "We must have Bogart. He's smart like hell, that man." In a way, he gave them great solace and comfort, I suppose. And so every morning, as I told you, Hat would shout very loudly, "What happening there, Bogart?" And he would wait for the indeterminate grumble which was Bogart saying, "What happening there, Hat?" But one morning, when Hat shouted, there was no reply. Something which had appeared unalterable was missing. Bogart had vanished, had left us without a word. The men in the street were silent and sorrowful for 2 whole days. They assembled in Bogart's little room. Hat lifted up the deck of cards that lay on Bogart's table and dropped 2 or 3 cards at a time, reflectively. Hat said, You think he go in Venezuela?
But no one knew.
Bogart told them so little. And the next morning, Hat got up and lit a cigarette and went to his back veranda and was on the point of shouting when he remembered. He milked the cows earlier than usual that morning, and the cows didn't like it. A month passed.
Then another month.
Bogart didn't return.
Hat and his friends began using Bogart's room as their clubhouse. They played wappy and drank rum and smoked, and sometimes brought the odd stray woman to the room.
Hat was presently involved with the police for gambling and sponsoring cockfighting, and he had to spend a lot of money to bribe his way out of trouble. It was as if Bogart had never come to Miguel Street. And after all, Bogart had been living in the street only for 4 years or so. He had come one day with a single suitcase, looking for a room, and he had spoken to Hat, who was squatting outside his gate, smoking a cigarette and reading the cricket scores in the evening paper. Even then he hadn't said much. All he said, that was Hat's story, was, "You know any rooms?" And Hat had led him to the next yard where there was this furnished servant room going for $8 a month. He had installed himself there immediately, brought out a pack of cards, and begun playing patience. This impressed Hat. For the rest, he had always remained a man of mystery. He became Patience. When Hat and everybody else had forgotten, or nearly forgotten Bogart, he returned. He turned up one morning just about 7, and found Eddowes and a woman on his bed. The woman jumped up and screamed. Eddowes jumped up, not so much afraid as embarrassed. Bogart said, "Move over. I'm tired, and I want to sleep." He slept until 5 that afternoon, and when he woke up, he found his room full of the old gang. Eddowes was being very loud and noisy to cover up his embarrassment. Hat had brought a bottle of rum. Hat said, "What happened in there, Bogart?" And he rejoiced when he found his cue taken up. "What happened in there, Hat?" Hat opened the bottle of rum and shouted to Boye to go buy a bottle of soda water. Bogart asked, "How the cows, Hat?" "They all right."
"And Boye?"
"He all right, too. Ain't you just hear me call him?"
"And Errol?"
"He all right, too. Well, what happened in Bogart? You all right?"
Bogart nodded and drank a long, Madrassi shot of rum. Then another, and another. And they had presently finished the bottle.
"Don't worry," Bogart said. "I go buy another."
They had never seen Bogart drink so much. They had never heard him talk so much, and they were alarmed. No one dared to ask Bogart where he had been. Bogart said,
"You boys been keeping my room hot all the time?"
"It wasn't the same without you,"
Hat replied. But they were all worried. Bogart was hardly opening his lips when he spoke. His mouth was twisted a little, and his accent was getting slightly American.
"Sure, sure," Bogart said, and he had got it right. He was just like an actor.
Hat wasn't sure that Bogart was drunk. In appearance, you must know, Hat recalled Rex Harrison, and he had done his best to strengthen the resemblance. He combed his hair backwards, screwed up his eyes, and he spoke very nearly like Harrison.
"Damn it, Bogart," Hat said. And he became very like Rex Harrison.
"You may as well tell us everything right away."
Bogart showed his teeth and laughed in a twisted, cynical way.
"Sure, I'll tell," he said, and got up and stuck his thumbs inside his waistband. "Sure, I'll tell everything."
He lit a cigarette, leaned back in such a way that the smoke got into his eyes, and squinting, he drawled out his story. He had got a job on a ship and had gone to British Guiana. There, he had deserted and gone into the interior. He became a cowboy on the Rupununi, smuggled things, he didn't say what, into Brazil, and had gathered some girls from Brazil and taken them to Georgetown.
he was running the best brothel in the town when the police treacherously took his bribes and arrested him.
It was a high-class place, he said. No bombs, judges and doctors and big-shot civil servants.
What happened? Eddowes asked. Jail?
How you so stupid? Hat said. Jail when the man here with we? But why you people so stupid? Why you don't let the man talk?
But Bogart was offended and refused to speak another word. From then on, the relationship between these men changed. Bogart became the Bogart of the films. Hat became Harrison. And the morning exchange became this.
Bogart. Shut up, Hat.
Bogart now became the most feared man in the street. Even Bigfoot was said to be afraid of him. Bogart drank and swore and gambled with the best. He shouted rude remarks at girls walking by themselves in the street. He bought a hat and pulled down the brim over his eyes. He became a regular sight, standing against the high concrete fence of his yard, hands in his pockets, one foot jammed against the wall, and an eternal cigarette in his mouth. Then he disappeared again. He was playing cards with the gang in his room, and he got up and said,
I'm going to the latrine.
They didn't see him for 4 months. When he returned, he had grown a little fatter, but he had become a little more aggressive. His accent was now pure American. To complete the imitation, he had begun being expansive towards children. He called out to them in the streets and gave them money to buy gum and chocolate. He loved stroking their heads and giving them good advice. The third time he went away and came back, he gave a great party in his room for all the children, or kids, as he called them. He bought cases of Solo and Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola and about a bushel of cakes. Then Sergeant Charles, the policeman who lived up Miguel Street at number 45, came and arrested Bogart.
Don't act tough, Bogart, Sergeant Charles said.
But Bogart failed to take the cue.
What happened, man? I ain't do anything, Sergeant Charles told him.
There was a little stir in the papers. The charge was bigamy. But it was up to Hat to find out all the inside details that the newspapers never mention. You see, Hat said on the pavement that evening, the man leave his first wife in Tunapuna and came to Port of Spain. They couldn't have children. He remain here feeling sad and small. He go away, find a girl in Carony, and he give she a baby. In Carony, they don't make joke about that sort of thing. And Bogart had to get married to the girl. But why he leave she? Eddowes asked. To be a man among we men. 2. The Thing Without a Name. The only thing that Popo, who called himself a carpenter, ever built was the little galvanized iron workshop under the mango tree at the back of his yard. And even that he didn't quite finish. He couldn't be bothered to nail on the sheets of galvanized iron for the roof, and kept them weighted down with huge stones. Whenever there was a high wind, the roof made a frightening banging noise and seemed ready to fly away. And yet, Popo was never idle. He was always busy hammering and sawing and planing. I liked watching him work. I liked the smell of the woods, sip and cedar and crapo. I liked the color of the shavings, and I liked the way the sawdust powdered Popo's kinky hair.
What are you making, Mr. Popo? I asked.
Popo would always say,
Ha, boy, that's the question.
I'm making the thing without a name. I liked Popo for that. I thought he was a poetic man. One day I said to Popo,
Give me something to make.
What you want to make? He said.
It was hard to think of something I really wanted.
You see, Popo said,
you thinking about the thing without a name. Eventually, I decided on an egg stand.
"Who you making it for?" Popo asked.
"Ma."
He laughed. "Think she going use it?"
My mother was pleased with the egg stand and used it for about a week. Then she seemed to forget all about it and began putting the eggs in bowls or plates just as she did before. And Popo laughed when I told him. He said,
"Boy, the only thing to make is the thing without a name."
After I painted the tailoring sign for Bogart, Popo made me do one for him as well. He took the little red stump of a pencil he had stuck over his ear and puzzled over the words. At first, he wanted to announce himself as an architect, but I managed to dissuade him. He wasn't sure about the spelling. The finished sign said, "Builder and contractor, carpenter and cabinet maker." And I signed my name as signwriter in the bottom right-hand corner. Popo liked standing up in front of the sign, but he had a little panic when people who didn't know about him came to inquire.
"The carpenter fella?" Popo would say. "He don't live here again."
I thought Popo was a much nicer man than Bogart. Bogart said little to me, but Popo was always ready to talk. He talked about serious things, like life and death and work, and I felt he really liked talking to me. Yet Popo was not a popular man in the street. They didn't think he was mad or stupid. Pat used to say, "Popo too conceited, you hear?" It was an unreasonable thing to say. Popo had the habit of taking a glass of rum to the pavement every morning. He never sipped the rum, but whenever he saw someone he knew, he dipped his middle finger in the rum, licked it, and then waved to the man.
"We could buy rum too," Pat used to say, "but we don't show off like Popo."
I myself never thought about it in that way, and one day I asked Popo about it. Popo said,
"Boy, in the morning, when the sun's shining and it's still cool and you just get up, it make you feel good to know that you could go out and stand up in the sun and have some rum."
Popo never made any money. His wife used to go out and work, and this was easy because they had no children. Popo said, "Women and them like work. Man not make for work." Pat said, "Popo is a man-woman, not a proper man." Popo's wife had a job as a cook in a big house near my school. She used to wait for me in the afternoons and take me into the big kitchen and give me a lot of nice things to eat. The only thing I didn't like was the way she sat and watched me while I ate. It was as though I was eating for her. She asked me to call her auntie. She introduced me to the gardener of the big house. He was a good-looking brown man, and he loved his flowers. I liked the gardens he looked after. The flower beds were always black and wet, and the grass green and damp and always cut. Sometimes he let me water the flower beds, and he used to gather the cut grass into little bags which he gave me to take home to my mother. Grass was good for the hens. One day, I missed Popo's wife. She wasn't waiting for me. Next morning, I didn't see Popo dipping his finger in the glass of rum on the pavement. And that evening, I didn't see Popo's wife. I found Popo sad in his workshop. He was sitting on a plank and twisting a bit of shaving around his fingers. Popo said,
"Your auntie gone, boy."
"Where, Mr. Popo?"
"Ha, boy, that's the question."
And he pulled himself up there. Popo found himself then a popular man. The news got around very quickly. And when Edo said one day, "I wonder what happened to Popo. Like he got no more rum," Hat jumped up and almost cuffed him. And then all the men began to gather in Popo's workshop. And they would talk about cricket and football and pictures, everything except women, just to try to cheer Popo up. Popo's workshop
no longer sounded with hammering and sawing. The sawdust no longer smelled fresh and became black, almost like dirt.
Popo began drinking a lot, and I didn't like him when he was drunk. He smelled of rum, and he used to cry and then grow angry and want to beat up everybody. That made him an accepted member of the gang.
Hat said,
"We was wrong about Popo. He is a man, like any of we."
Popo liked the new companionship. He was at heart a loquacious man, and always wanted to be friendly with the men of the street, and he was always surprised that he was not liked. So it looked as though he had got what he wanted. But Popo was not really happy. The friendship had come a little too late, and he found he didn't like it as much as he'd expected.
Hat tried to get Popo interested in other women, but Popo wasn't interested.
Popo didn't think I was too young to be told anything.
"Boy, when you grow old as me," he said once, "you find that you don't care for the things you thought you would like if you could afford them."
That was his way of talking, in riddles.
Then one day, Popo left us.
Hat said,
"You don't have to tell me where he gone.
He gone looking for his wife."
Edward said,
"Think she going come back with he?"
Hat said, "Let we wait and see." We didn't have to wait long. It came out in the papers.
Hat said it was just what he expected. Popo had beaten up a man in Arima. The man had taken his wife away.
"It was the gardener who used to give me bags of grass."
Nothing much happened to Popo. He had to pay a fine, but they let him off otherwise. The magistrate said that Popo had better not molest his wife again.
They made a calypso about Popo that was the rage that year. It was the road march for the carnival, and the Andrews sisters sang it for an American recording company. A certain carpenter fella went to Arima, looking for a mopsy called Imelda.
It was a great thing for the street.
At school, I used to say, "The carpenter fella was a good friend of mine." And at cricket matches and at the races, Hat used to say,
"Know him? God, I used to drink with that man night and day. Boy, he could carry his liquor."
Popo wasn't the same man when he came back to us. He growled at me when I tried to talk to him, and he drove out Hat and the others when they brought a bottle of rum to the workshop.
Hat said,
"Woman, send that man mad, you hear?"
But the old noises began to be heard once more from Popo's workshop. He was working hard, and I wondered whether he was still making the thing without a name. But I was too afraid to ask. He ran an electric light to the workshop and began working in the nighttime. Vans stopped outside his house and were always depositing and taking away things. Then Popo began painting his house. He used a bright green, and he painted the roof a bright red. Hat said, "The man really mad," and added, "Like he getting married again." Hat wasn't too far wrong. One day, about 2 weeks later, Popo returned, and he brought a woman with him. It was his wife, my auntie.
"You see the sort of thing woman is," Hat commented.
"You see the sort of thing they like?
Not the man, but the new house paint up and all the new furniture inside it.
I bet you if the man in Arima had a new house and new furnitures, she wouldn't have come back with Popo." But I didn't mind. I was glad. It was good to see Popo standing outside with his glass of rum in the mornings and dipping his finger into the rum and waving at his friends. And it was good to ask him again, "What you making, Mr. Popo?" And to get the old answer.
"Ha, boy, that's the question.
I'm making the thing without a name." Popo returned very quickly to his old way of living, and he was still devoting his time to making the thing without a name.
He had stopped working, and his wife got her job with the same people near my school. People in the street were almost angry with Popo when his wife came back. They felt that all their sympathy had been mocked and wasted. And again Hat was saying, "That blasted Popo, too conceited. You hear?" But this time, Popo didn't mind. He used to tell me, "Boy, go home and pray tonight that you get happy like me." What happened afterwards happened so suddenly that we didn't even know it had happened. Even Hat didn't know about it until he read it in the papers. Hat always read the papers. He read them from about 10 in the morning until about 6 in the evening. Hat shouted out, "But what is this I see?" And he showed us the headlines. Calypso Carpenter Jailed. It was a fantastic story. Popo had been stealing things left and right. All the new furnitures, as Hat called them, hadn't been made by Popo. He had stolen things and simply remodeled them. He had stolen too much, as a matter of fact, and had had to sell the things he didn't want. That was how he had been caught. And we understand now why the vans were always outside Popo's house. Even the paint and the brushes with which he had redecorated the house had been stolen. Hat spoke for all of us when he said, "That man too foolish. Why he had to sell what he thief? Just tell me that. Why?" We agreed it was a stupid thing to do. But we felt deep inside ourselves that Popo was really a man. Perhaps a bigger man than any of us. And as for my auntie, Hat said, "How much jail he get? A year? With 3 months off for good behavior, that's 9 months in all. And I give she 3 months good behavior too. And after that, it ain't going to have no more Imelda in Miguel Street, you hear?" But Imelda never left Miguel Street. She not only kept her job as cook, but she started taking in washing and ironing as well. No one in the street felt sorry that Popo had gone to jail because of the shame. After all, that was a thing that could happen to any of us. They felt sorry only that Imelda was going to be left alone for so long. He came back as a hero. He was one of the boys. He was a better man than either Hat or Bogart. But for me, he had changed. And the change made me sad. For Popo began working. He began making Morris chairs and tables and wardrobes for people. And when I asked him, "Mr. Popo, when you going start making the thing without a name again?" he growled at me. "You too troublesome," he said. "Go away quick before I lay my hand on you." 3. George and the Pink House. I was much more afraid of George than I was of Bigfoot, although Bigfoot was the biggest and the strongest man in the street. George was short and fat. He had a gray mustache and a big belly. He looked harmless enough, but he was always muttering to himself and cursing, and I never tried to become friendly with him. He was like the donkey he had tied in the front of his yard, gray and old and silent, except when it brayed loudly. You felt that George was never really in touch with what was going on around him all the time. And I found it strange that no one should have said that George was mad, while everybody said that Man-Man, whom I liked, was mad. George's house also made me feel afraid. It was a broken-down wooden building, painted pink on the outside, and the galvanized iron roof was brown from rust. One door, the one to the right, was always left open. The inside walls had never been painted, and were gray and black with age. There was a dirty bed in one corner, and in another there was a table and a stool. That was all. No curtains, no pictures on the wall. And even Bogart had a picture of Lauren Bacall in his room.
I found it hard to believe that George had a wife and a son and a daughter. Like Popo, George was happy to let his wife do all the work in the house and the yard. They kept cows, and again, I hated George for that. Because the water from his pens made the gutter stink. And when we were playing cricket on the pavement, the ball often got wet in the gutter. Mboyi and Errol used to wet the ball deliberately in the stinking gutter. They wanted to make it shoot. George's wife was never a proper person. I always thought of her just as George's wife, and that was all. And I always thought, too, that George's wife was nearly always in the cow pen. And while George sat on the front concrete step outside the open door of his house, his wife was busy. George never became one of the gang in Miguel Street. He didn't seem to mind. He had his wife and his daughter and his son. He beat them all. And when the boy, Elias, grew too big, George beat his daughter and his wife more than ever. The blows didn't appear to do the mother any good. She just grew thinner and thinner. But the daughter, Dolly, thrived on it. She grew fatter and fatter, and giggled more and more every year. Elias, the son, grew more and more stern, but he never spoke a hard word to his father. Hat said, "That boy, Elias, have too much good mind." One day, Bogart, of all people, said, "Ha! I'm mad to break old George's tail up, you hear?" And the few times when Elias joined the crowd, Hat would say, "Boy, I too sorry for you. Why you don't fix the old man up good?" Elias would say, "It is all God work." Elias was only 14 or so at the time, but that was the sort of boy he was. He was serious, and he had big ambitions. I began to be terrified of George, particularly when he bought two great Alsatian dogs and tied them to pickets at the foot of the concrete steps. Every morning and afternoon when I passed his house, he would say to the dogs, "Shook him!" And the dogs would bound and leap and bark, and I could see their ropes stretched tight, and I always felt that the ropes would break at the next leap. Now, when Hat had an Alsatian, he made it like me. And Hat had said to me then, "Never afraid, dog. Go brave. Don't run." And so I used to walk slowly past George's house, lengthening out my torture. I don't know whether George disliked me personally, or whether he simply had no use for people in general. I never discussed it with the other boys in the street, because I was too ashamed to say I was afraid of barking dogs. Presently, though, I grew used to the dogs, and even George's laughter when I passed the house didn't worry me very much. One day, George was on the pavement as I was passing, and I heard him mumbling. I heard him mumble again that afternoon, and again the following day. He was saying, "Horse face." Sometimes he said, "Like it only have horse face people living in this place." Sometimes he said, "Short ass." But how would have people so short ass in the world? I pretended not to hear, of course. But after a week or so, I was almost in tears whenever George mumbled these things. One evening, when we had stopped playing cricket on the pavement because Boy had hit the ball into Miss Hilton's yard, and that was a lost ball. It counted six and out. That evening, I asked Elias, "But what your father have with me so? Why he does keep on calling me names?" Hat laughed, and Elias looked a little solemn. Hat said, "What sort of names?" I said, "The fat old man does call me horse face." I couldn't bring myself to say the other name. Hat began laughing. Elias said, "Boy, my father is a funny man, but you must forgive him. What he say don't matter. He old. He have life hard. He not educated like we here. He have a soul just like any of we too, besides." And he was so serious that Hat didn't laugh. And whenever I walked past George's house, I kept on saying to myself,
I must forgive him. He ain't know what he doing. And then Elias's mother died and had the shabbiest and the saddest and the loneliest funeral Miguel Street had ever seen. That empty front room became sadder and more frightening for me. The strange thing was that I felt a little sorry for George. The Miguel Street men held a post-mortem outside Hat's house. Hat said, "He did beat she too bad." Bogart nodded and drew a circle on the pavement with his right index finger. Edward said, "I think he killed she, you know. Boy tell me that the evening before she died, he heard George giving the woman licks like fire." Hat said, "What do you think they have doctors and magistrates in this place for? For fun?" "But I telling you," Edward said, "it really true. Boy, he wouldn't lie about a thing like that. The woman dead from blows, I telling you. London can take it, but not George, wife." Not one of the men said a word for George. Boy said something I didn't expect him to say. He said, "The person I really feel sorry for is Dolly. You suppose he going to beat she still?" Hat said wisely, "Let we wait and see." Elias dropped out of our circle. George was very sad for the first few days after the funeral. He drank a lot of rum and went about crying in the streets, beating his chest and asking everybody to forgive him and to take pity on him, a poor widower. He kept up the drinking into the following weeks, and he was still running up and down the street, making everyone feel foolish when he asked for forgiveness. "My son Elias," George used to say, "my son Elias forgive me, and he is an educated boy." When he came to Hat, Hat said, "What happening to your cows? You milking them? You feeding them? You want to kill your cows now too?" George sold all his cows to Hat. "God will say it's robbery," Hat laughed. "I say it's a bargain." Edward said, "It good for George. He beginning to pay for his sins." "Well, I look at it this way," Hat said. "I give him enough money to remain drunk for 2 whole months. George was away from Miguel Street for a week. During that time, we saw more of Dolly. She swept out the front room and begged flowers of the neighbors and put them in the room. She giggled more than ever. Someone in the street, not me, poisoned the 2 Alsatians. We hoped that George had gone away for good. He did come back, however, still drunk, but no longer crying or helpless. And he had a woman with him. She was a very Indian woman, a little old, but she looked strong enough to handle George. "She looked like a drinker herself," Hat said. This woman took control of George's house, and once more Dolly retreated into the back, where the empty cow pens were. We heard stories of beatings, and everybody said he was sorry for Dolly and the new woman. My heart went out to the woman and Dolly. I couldn't understand how anybody in the world would want to live with George, and I wasn't surprised when one day, about 2 weeks later, Popo told me, "George new wife leave him. You ain't here?" Hat said, "I wonder what he going do when the money I give him finish." We soon saw. The pink house, almost overnight, became a full and noisy place. There were many women about, talking loudly and not paying too much attention to the way they dressed. And whenever I passed the pink house, these women shouted abusive remarks at me. And some of them did things with their mouths, inviting me to come to Muma. And there were not only these new women. Many American soldiers drove up in jeeps, and Miguel Street became full of laughter and shrieks. Hat said, "That man George given the street a bad name, you know." It was as though Miguel Street belonged to these new people. Hat and the rest of the boys were no longer assured of privacy when they sat down to talk things over on the pavement. But Bogart became friendly with the new people and spent 2 or 3 evenings a week with them. He pretended he was disgusted at what he saw, but I didn't believe him because he was always going back.
"What happened to Dolly?" Hat asked him one day.
"She dey," Bogart said, meaning that she was all right.
"I know she dey," Hat said. "But how she dey?"
"Well, she cleaning and cooking."
"For everybody?"
"Everybody." Elias had a room of his own, which he never left whenever he came home. He ate his meals outside. He was trying to study for some important exam. He had lost interest in his family, Bogart said, or rather implied. George was still drinking a lot, but he was prospering. He was wearing a suit now, and a tie. Hat said, "He must be making a lot of money, if he have to bribe all the policemen and them." What I couldn't understand at all, though, was the way these new women behaved to George. They all appeared to like him, as well as respect him. And George wasn't attempting to be nice in return, either. He remained himself. One day, he said to everyone, "Dolly ain't have no mooma now. I have to be father and mother to the child. And I say, it's high time Dolly get married." His choice fell on a man called Reza. It was hard to think of a more suitable name for this man. He was small. He was thin. He had a neat, sharp mustache above neat, tiny lips. The creases on his trousers were always sharp and clean and straight. And he was supposed to carry a knife. Hat didn't like Dolly marrying Reza. "He too sharp for we," he said. "He is the sort of man who wouldn't think anything about forgetting a knife in your back, you know?" But Dolly still giggled. Reza and Dolly were married at church, and they came back to a reception in the pink house. The women were all dressed up, and there were lots of American soldiers and sailors drinking and laughing and congratulating George. The women and the Americans made Dolly and Reza kiss and kiss, and they cheered. Dolly giggled. Hat said, "She ain't giggling, you know. She crying, really." Elias wasn't at home that day. The women and the Americans sang Sweet 16 and As Time Goes By. Then they made Dolly and Reza kiss again. Someone shouted, "Speech!" And everybody laughed and shouted, "Speech! Speech!" Reza left Dolly standing by herself giggling. "Speech! Speech!" the wedding guests called. Dolly only giggled more. Then George spoke out. "Dolly, you married it true, but don't think you too big for me to put you across my lap and cut your tail." He said it in a jocular manner, and the guests laughed. Then Dolly stopped giggling and looked stupidly at the people. For a moment so brief you could scarcely measure it, there was absolute silence. Then an American sailor waved his hands drunkenly and shouted,
"You can put this girl to better work, George."
And everybody laughed. Dolly picked up a handful of gravel from the yard and was making as if to throw it at the sailor. But she stopped suddenly and burst into tears. There was much laughing and cheering and shouting. I never knew what happened to Dolly. Edward said one day that she was living in Sangre Grande. Hat said he saw her selling in the George Street Market. But she had left the street, left it for good. As the months went by, the women began to disappear, and the numbers of jeeps that stopped outside George's house grew smaller.
"You gotta be organized," Hat said.
Bogart nodded. Hat added, "And they have lots of nice places all over the place in Port of Spain these days. The trouble with George is that he's too stupid for a big man." Hat was a prophet. Within 6 months, George was living alone in his pink house. I used to see him then, sitting on the steps, but he never looked at me anymore. He looked old and weary and very sad. He died soon afterwards. Hat and the boys got some money together, and we buried him at La Perouse Cemetery. Elias turned up for the funeral. 4. His chosen calling. After midnight, there were two regular noises in the street. At about 2 o'clock, you heard the sweepers. And then, just before dawn, the scavenging carts came, and you heard the men scraping off the rubbish the sweepers had gathered into heaps. No boy in the street particularly wished to be a sweeper. But if you asked any boy what he would like to be, he would say, "I going be a cart driver." There was certainly a glamour to driving the blue carts. The men were aristocrats. They worked early in the morning and had the rest of the day free. And then they were always going on strike. They didn't strike for much. They struck for certain things like a cent more a day. They struck if someone was laid off. They struck when the war began. They struck when the war ended. They struck when India got independence. They struck when Gandhi died. Eddowes, who was a driver, was admired by most of the boys. He said his father was the best cart driver of his day, and he told us great stories of the old man's skill. Eddowes came from a low Hindu caste, and there was a lot of truth in what he said. His skill was a sort of family skill, passing from father to son. One day I was sweeping the pavement in front of the house where I lived, and Eddowes came and wanted to take away the broom from me. I liked sweeping, and I didn't want to give him the broom. "Boy, what you know about sweeping?" Eddowes asked, laughing. I said, "What, it have so much to know?" Eddowes said, "This is my job, boy. I have experience. Wait until you big like me." I gave him the broom. I was sad for a long time afterwards. It seemed that I would never, never grow as big as Eddowes, never have that thing he called experience. I began to admire Eddowes more than ever, and more than ever I wanted to be a cart driver. But Elias was not that sort of boy. When we formed the Junior Miguel Street Club, squatted on the pavement, talking, like Hat and Bogart and the others, about things like life and cricket and football, I said to Elias, "So you don't want to be a cart driver? What do you want to be then? A sweeper?" Elias spat neatly into the gutter and looked down. He said very earnestly, "I think I going be a doctor, you hear?" If Boye or Errol had said something like that, we would all have laughed. But we recognized that Elias was different, that Elias had brains. We all felt sorry for Elias. His father, George, brutalized the boy with blows, but Elias never cried, never spoke a word against his father. One day I was going to Chin's shop to buy 3 cents worth of butter, and I asked Elias to come with me. I didn't see George about, and I thought it was safe. We were just about 2 houses away when we saw George. Elias grew scared. George came up and said sharply, "Where are you going?" And at the same time, he landed a powerful cuff on Elias's jaw. George liked beating Elias. He used to tie him with rope, and then beat him with rope he had soaked in the gutters of his cow pen. Elias didn't cry even then. And shortly after, I would see George laughing with Elias. And George used to say to me, "I know what you're thinking. You're wondering how me and he get so friendly so quick." The more I disliked George, the more I liked Elias. I was prepared to believe that he would become a doctor someday. Errol said, "I bet you when he come doctor and thing, he could forget the rest of we, Elias." A small smile appeared on Elias's lips. "Nah," he said.
I wouldn't be like that. I could give a lot of money and thing to you and Boyi and the rest of you fellows. And Elias waved his small hands, and we thought we could see the Cadillac and the black bag and the tube thing that Elias was going to have when he became a doctor. Elias began going to the school at the other end of Miguel Street. It didn't really look like a school at all. It looked just like any house to me, but there was a sign outside that said, Titus Hoyt, I.A., London External. Passes in the Cambridge School Certificate guaranteed. The odd thing was that although George beat Elias at the slightest opportunity, he was very proud that his son was getting an education. The boy learning a hell of a lot, you know. He read in Spanish, French, and Latin, and he write in Spanish, French, and Latin. The year before his mother died, Elias sat for the Cambridge Senior School Certificate. Titus Hoyt came down to our end of the street.
That boy going past with honors, Titus Hoyt said. With honors.
We saw Elias dressed in neat khaki trousers and white shirt, going to the examination room, and we looked at him with awe. Errol said, Everything Elias write not remaining here, you know. Every word that boy write going to England.
It didn't sound true.
What do you think it is at all? Errol said. Elias have brains, you know. Elias's mother died in January, and the results came out in March. Elias hadn't passed. Hat looked through the list in the Guardian over and over again, looking for Elias's name, saying,
You never know. People always make a mistake, especially when it have so much names.
Elias's name wasn't in the paper. Boy, he said,
What else you expect? Who correct the papers? Englishmen, not so? You expect them to give Elias a pass?
Elias was with us, looking sad and not saying a word. Hat said,
Is a damn shame. If they know what hell the boy have to put up with, they would have passed him quick, quick.
Titus Hoyt said,
Don't worry. Rome wasn't built in a day.
This year, things going to be much, much better. We go show those Englishmen and them.
Elias left us, and he began living with Titus Hoyt. We saw next to nothing of him. He was working night and day. One day in the following March, Titus Hoyt rode up to us and said,
You hear what happened?
What happened?
Hat asked.
The boy is a genius, Titus Hoyt said.
Which boy? Errol asked.
Elias.
What Elias do?
The boy gone and passed the Cambridge Senior School Certificate.
Hat whistled.
The Cambridge Senior School Certificate?
Titus Hoyt smiled.
That self. He get a third grade. His name going to be in the papers tomorrow. I always say it, and I saying it again now. This boy Elias have too much brains.
Hat said later.
It's too bad that Elias' father did. He was a good for nothing, but he wanted to see his son an educated man.
Elias came that evening, and everybody, boys and men, gathered around him. They talked about everything but books, and Elias, too, was talking about things like pictures and girls and cricket. He was looking very solemn, too. There was a pause once, and Hat said,
What are you going to do now, Elias? Look for work?
Elias spat.
Nah, I think I will write the exam again.
I said,
But why? I want a second grade.
We understood.
He wanted to be a doctor.
Elias sat down on the pavement and said,
Yes, boy, I think I going to take that exam again. And this year, I going to be so good that this Mr. Cambridge go bald when he read what I write for him.
We were silent, in wonder.
It's the English and literature that has beat me.
In Elias's mouth,
literature was the most beautiful word I heard. It sounded like something to eat, something rich, like chocolate.
Hat said,
"You mean you have to read a lot of poetry and think?"
Elias nodded. We felt it wasn't fair, making a boy like Elias do literature and poetry. Elias moved back into the pink house, which had been empty since his father died. He was studying and working. He went back to Titus Hoyt's school, not as pupil, but as a teacher. And Titus Hoyt said he was giving him $40 a month. Titus Hoyt added,
"He worth it, too. He is one of the brightest boys in Portisbane."
Now that Elias was back with us, we noticed him better. He was the cleanest boy in the street. He bathed twice a day and scrubbed his teeth twice a day. He did all this standing up at the tap in front of the house. He swept the house every morning before going to school. He was the opposite of his father. His father was short and fat and dirty. He was tall and thin and clean. His father drank and swore. He never drank, and no one ever heard him use a bad word. My mother used to say to me,
"Why you don't take after Elias? I really don't know what sort of son God give me, you hear?"
And whenever Hat or Edward beat Boyi and Errol, they always said,
"Why you beating we for? Not everybody could be like Elias, you know."
Hat used to say, "And it ain't only that he got brains. The boy Elias have nice ways, too." So I think I was a little glad when Elias sat the examination for the third time and failed. Hat said,
"You see how we catch these Englishmen in them?
Nobody here can tell me that the boy didn't pass the exam. But you think they gonna want to give him a better grade? Ha!"
And everybody said, "Is a real shame." And when Hat asked Elias, "What are you going to do now, boy?" Elias said, "You know, I think I could take up a job. I think I could be a sanitary inspector." We saw him in khaki uniform and khaki topi, going from house to house with a little notebook.
"Yes," Elias said, "sanitary inspector. That's what I'm going to be."
Hat said,
"It have a lot of money in that, I think.
I hear your father George used to pay the sanitary inspector $5 a month to keep his mouth shut.
Let me say you get about 10 or even 8 people like that. That's, let me see, 10 fives is 50, 8 fives is 40. There, 50. $40 straight. And mark you, that ain't counting your salary."
Elias said,
"Is not the money I thinking about. I really like the work."
It was easy to understand that.
Elias said, "But it have a exam, you know?"
Hat said,
"But they don't send the papers to England for that."
Elias said,
"Nah, but still, I afraid exams and things, you know. I ain't have any luck with them."
Boyi said,
"But I thought you was thinking of taking up doctoring."
Hat said, "Boy, I going to cut your little tail if you don't shut up." But boy didn't mean anything bad. Elias said, "I changed my mind. I think I want to be a sanitary inspector. I really like the work." For 3 years, Elias sat the sanitary inspector's examination, and he failed every time. Elias began saying,
"But what the hell you expect in Trinidad? You got to bribe everybody if you want to get your toenail cut."
Hat said, "I met a man from a boat the other day, and he tell me that the sanitary inspector exams in British Guyana much easier. You could go to BG and take the exams there and come back and work here." Elias flew to BG, wrote the exam, failed it, and flew back. Hat said, "I meet a man from Barbados. He tell me that the exam's easier in Barbados. It easy, he say." Elias flew to Barbados,
wrote the exam, failed it, and flew back. Hat said, "I meet a man from Grenada the other day." Elias said, "Shut your ass up.